Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 140. My name is John. That's the time you get me running, and you know I'll be around. I got a couple of things I need to say before I get to this month's topic. Another fond memory of my childhood has gone away. As I was recording this podcast, I saw the news that Marky Post passed away from cancer at the age of 70. As you can tell from listening to this podcast, when I'm not talking about politics, I really like offbeat and iconoclastic things. I mean, look at this month's topic. Growing up, I loved the strange characters from the sitcom Night Court. I told you about my story of wanting to meet Harry Anderson, but missed out because he left New Orleans to escape Katrina the day that I went by his magic shop. As a typical hormone-fueled 80s youth, I had a huge crush on Marky Post. She was often the sane one in a cast of crazies, and she was a perfect fit in the ensemble. A toast to your memory, Marky. Rest in peace. Also, a special shout out to the Blatcast for having me on to talk about the Suicide Squad. If you watched that episode, you've already heard some of the points I will make in this podcast, and you'll hear what I was going to say about Harley Quinn before my internet cut out. Thank you again, Christian Blatt, and as always, if you, Will, or Jeff are ever in South Texas, drinks are on me. I didn't hate David Ayer's 2016 Suicide Squad, but it was at the bottom of my rankings of DCEU movies until Wonder Woman 84 came out. It doesn't surprise me that Ayer has been saying studio executives interfered too much with his vision. As I've said in the past, the DCEU's main villain is not Darkseid, it's Warner Brothers executives. I'd love to see his version of the film, even though the Snyder Cut is probably the only time something like that will ever happen. That being said, if Ayer is responsible for dialogue like, "Stay evil, dollface," maybe I don't want to see his vision. It never made sense to me to send a team of street-level villains against an infinitely more powerful magical force. And yes, even though he easily ranks at the bottom of my cinematic Joker list, I didn't abhor Leto's version like most people, but I really think that had more to do with reading the Death in the Family story in the comic books. Yes, Gangster Joker was off-putting, but not as much when you compare it to a Joker who has his face removed, reattached, and tries to convince Batman that they are the same as a married couple. There was plenty of me to like about that previous movie. Viola Davis, Margot Robbie, and Jai Courtney were all great in their roles, as was Will Smith, with the exception of a few lines of god-awful dialogue. I mean, pointing his finger at the magical being about to destroy the world and shouting, "Lady, you are evil," is just so stupid. Killer Croc actually looked pretty cool for a character that you would have expected to be completely CGI. For my friends who were unfamiliar with the squad, El Diablo was their favorite character, and they were bummed he didn't make it out of the movie alive. There were some good character moments and action sequences, and I got to see some characters I never expected to see in live action, so it was a B-plus for me in my initial reaction. Rewatching it a couple of times over the years, I'd probably drop that down to a C-plus, and maybe even lower if Wonder Woman 84 hadn't been so bad. For me, 2016 Suicide Squad is just okay. The Suicide Squad from director James Gunn dropped on HBO Max on August 5th at 6 p.m. Central Time. I waited for Gina to get home and started watching it at 6:30 p.m. This is now a total spoiler-filled podcast. podcast, I will unapologetically spoil the fuck out of everything in this movie. If you don't want to know who lives, who dies, and the secret reason why the squad is even there to begin with, do not continue. Go watch the damn movie and come back later. My initial reaction is The Suicide Squad is a much better story than the first movie, even if it did follow much the same plot as the first one. A bunch of expendable villains are sent to clean up a government mistake. It was demented, twisted, occasionally pretty gross. And what exactly does James Gunn have against birds? I really liked this movie, but I didn't love it. And I'm going to try to pinpoint why as I go along. Since it's usually the way I do it anyway, let me start with the things I didn't like about it. Small stuff first, and I'll build up to bigger problems. In the trailer, they used a great song by Steely Dan, Dirty Work. It would have been great if they could have placed it somewhere in the movie, even in the credits. I know no animals were harmed, but damn, what's with all the bird murder? I mean, you open with Savant killing a bird for no reason, which I guess is to remind you that he's a bad guy and that you don't mind seeing him die and setting up a joke later on for another bird pecking at his corpse. Then you have the bad guy general set fire to a bunch of caged birds. I mean, open the fucking aviary and let him go. Don't burn him alive. I mean, what the hell, James Gunn? Just because tweets got you temporarily fired doesn't mean you take it out on birds. As the helicopter took off with the first group, I realized everyone except for Flag and Harley were going to die. If you watched the first trailer carefully, you would see Waller had triggered Savant's bomb, so I knew that was coming. I think Mongal had one line and some screaming before she died. I'm not familiar with her specifically, but I am familiar with her brother Mongol, who is close to Superman-level power. So it seemed odd for her to die in a helicopter crash. But she's a throwaway villain anyway. Javelin seemed to only be there so Harley could use his weapon later on, so he's gunned down. It's a shame that Nathan Fillion and Pete Davidson would go out after only a few lines of dialogue, but you don't see them fighting Starro in the trailer, so you had to figure they had to be taken out sometime before the third act, if nothing else. That being said, my wife adores both Villian and Davidson, and near the end of the movie she said, and I'm paraphrasing, Nathan and Pete are gone in the first 5 minutes, but the fucking shark survives? I thought the survivors of the first group would pick up intel that would lead to putting together the second team, but as you know, the first group was just a distraction. That being said, why would Waller put Flag in such an obvious no-win situation? Was she trying to get rid of him? I know that the entire concept of the Suicide Squad means some or most won't make it out alive. You had to figure some character would be killed that you didn't expect or didn't want. I had three of those characters. I still can't believe they killed off Rick Flag. I really thought Peacemaker was just going to injure him, not stab him in the heart. Flag was such a mainstay character in the comic that I really expected him to make it, especially since they make such vast improvements to the character from the first movie. In the same way, Captain Boomerang has a long history with the squad in the comics, and Jai Courtney was a lot of fun playing the more depraved side of Digger. I mean, have him injured and being treated by the rebels so he's out of the action but survives. I have to admit, though, that smile he gives Harley the second before the helicopter wreckage hits him is spot on for the character. I'll get to the third disappointing death in a minute. I was really hoping that after Bloodsport shoots Peacemaker in the neck, that meant Peacemaker's upcoming television show would be a prequel. In the post-credit scene, where the doctor says they were surprised his heart was still beating, I had a very brief second of hope that she was talking about Flag. Oh, fuck. It's Peacemaker. How do you make a spin-off television series about easily the least likable character in the movie? Peacemaker is usually written these days as a narrow-minded douchebag, and the movie completely leans into that. That whole bit about eating the dicks on the beach was absolutely the stupidest bit in the entire movie. At best, Cena has been moderately funny in the things I've seen him in, so I didn't care much for him. And I will watch his HBO Max show with all the expectation I had watching Gotham. For those of you who don't know, I think Gotham is easily the worst DC television show from the last 10 years. I do admit I am pissed off at myself for not seeing the obvious clue that he was Waller's plant when Bloodsport pointed out they both had the same set of skills. The King Shark gags wore a little thin on me about halfway through the movie, but his aquarium scene was just enough to get me to the end without giving up on him. As I mentioned earlier, Gina didn't care for the character at all. She's not a big fan of animal hybrids or any kind of talking animal, and no matter how much I try, she refuses to embrace Gorilla Grodd. Am I the only one surprised that Waller's staff, who knocked her out and basically mutinied against her, survived? Hell, Waller killed her staff in the first movie just because they knew her secret. I'm surprised she didn't wake up, grab a gun, and massacre the room. They did the same thing to Polka Dot Man in this movie as they did to El Diablo in the last one. But I guess building up the redemption of a villain and making the character likable is what makes the death so disheartening. I think it's also odd that both Diablo and Dot were wary of showing off their powers, and in the end, both strike a strong blow to the bad guys before getting killed. Gina also hated Dot. Not as much as King Shark, but a lot of people can't get past the silliness of the character. Since I'm talking about parallels, as I mentioned earlier, I found it odd both films followed the same basic plot. A team of villains is sent on a mission that turns out aids in the cover-up of government corruption. The villains actually complete the task, then decide they have to do the right thing and take out the bad guy. Harley Quinn uses someone else's weapon to take down the big bad. My point is, the first one probably would have worked if Warner Brothers executives didn't fuck with David Ayer's vision. Again, my biggest problem with the first movie was pitting a bunch of street-level villains against a magical threat that should have easily defeated them. And it feels so stupid that the Enchantress didn't win. The good thing about the Suicide Squad is the villains have more power, and even though Starro is still a big freaking monster, you get the feeling that it can be defeated. In that respect, this is a step in the right direction, but I'm still not entirely sold on Starro. For those of you unfamiliar, Starro is the threat the Justice League faced in their very first appearance. It is classic 1960s comic book outlandishness. Over the years, it has been a challenge, but some writers have made a giant starfish feel like a legitimate global threat. There was a pretty good story late in the satellite era of the League, and Grant Morrison later had a good take on the character as well. It got pretty bizarre in recent years, including Jaro, a piece of Starro that becomes sentient, grows up in a jar, and becomes an ally to Batman, up to and including wearing a Robin costume. But for any detractors, there is one very important piece of trivia. Starro is one of the few villains to face both DC's Justice League and Marvel's Avengers. This is not Starro's first appearance in live action. It can be seen very briefly in a background fight during the first episode of the short-lived comedy Powerless. It's wild. It's nutty. It's an absolute gonzo choice for the big bad. Unfortunately, during my first viewing of the movie, as much as I wanted this to work, And as much as I wanted to see this crazy fucking giant alien starfish steal the show, it just left me empty. Why? Well, first of all, I couldn't stop thinking how goofy it looked. And this is coming from a guy who read those classic comics and had no problem with little replicas attaching themselves to people's faces and controlling them. However, in live action, I just had trouble with it. You'd think in a movie with Weasel, Polka Dot Man, and the Detachable Kid, I'd be okay to roll with the insanity. But maybe there's another reason it left me cold. It's established in the movie this alien was basically imprisoned for decades, and that if one of its little spores attached itself to a person, they were basically dead. After it escapes, it keeps insisting through its controlled humans that the city belongs to it. So you think it's going to live up to its name and conquer the city on its way to try to conquer the world. However, as it was dying, by the way, Harley Quinn plunging herself into Starro through its eye, followed by rats eating it to death from the inside, was pretty fucking gross. And how could she get in with the javelin when bullets couldn't get through? Anyway, as it was dying, Starro laments that it used to float among the stars. Wait, so it wasn't a conqueror, it's just yearning to be free? In that last instant, it almost became a sympathetic character, and then it's dead. If it was a conqueror, then let it conquer. But don't use its final words to insinuate all it wanted was to go back home. One or the other, please. Before I get into things that I liked, I want to take a moment to update my list of characters I never expected to see in live action. This used to be exclusively a television list because the movies usually suck to A-listers. Now, I have a TV list, currently topped by the Nuclear Family from Titans, and a movie list. King Shark, Thinker, and, as mentioned earlier, Starro all made appearances on TV in the past few years, so I usually put a character with the medium where they first appeared. I can basically take all the new characters that debuted in The Suicide Squad and add them to the list. Weasel, Blackguard, Savant, Javelin, Mongal, Ratcatcher, Bloodsport, Polka Dot Man, Calendar Man, Double Down, and Crazy Quilt. Those last three were briefly seen early on in the prison. Actually, now that I think about it, Double Down did make an appearance on television a few years ago in either Arrow or Flash, I don't remember which one, so I'll keep him on the TV list. I'm debating internally whether or not the movie list is still topped by Mr. Mind from Shazam, or if Arms Fall Off Boy replaces him. That's TDK's original name from the comics. So, it's a toss-up between an evil alien caterpillar or one of the all-time stupidest characters ever created, which you gotta believe is the main reason Gunn included him in the movie and had someone like Nathan Fillion play him. Speaking of all-time stupid characters, Gunn stated he included Polka Dot Man because he believed that he was the stupidest villain ever created. I have to disagree. That belongs to Condiment King. Look it up, and hope that he makes it into the sequel. Let me take a quick moment to make the one political statement I have regarding the movie. I know this is a work of fiction, with superheroes, supervillains, outlandish aliens, and wacky superpowers, but the one thing that shouldn't surprise you is the government trying to cover up something horrible they did. From Tulsa to Tuskegee, Operation Sea Spray to MK Ultra, don't ever think the government is doing anything without ulterior motives. Art is indeed imitating life. This movie, overall, is a vast improvement to the original. The character development was better, the action is improved, the executives left the director alone. The dialogue was mostly better. The funny moments, for the most part, seemed organic to the situation and the characters. I really liked the chapter title cards, or time shift alerts, in the movie. 3 days earlier is spelled out in soap suds on the toilet Bloodsport is cleaning. There's several throughout the movie, but my absolute favorite was Jotunheim, spelled out in the debris on the rooftop. Similarly to the title cards, some of the other subtle things in the movie worked really well. Sebastian the Rat was a great little addition, not annoyingly overplayed like a certain baby tree in Gunn's other superhero movies. The panicked look on Elba's face in the closing moment of the film, when he slowly and begrudgingly pets Sebastian, who is curled up on his leg to sleep, was a great ending. Probably the highlight for me of all the Peacemaker scenes in the movie is the competition between him and Bloodsport as they go through the enemy camp to rescue Flag. It had a comic book cool feel to it, as they made their way through like they were in some kind of perverted game of horse. About halfway into the scene, it dawned on me that these were probably the rebels fighting against the dictators, and not the military camp that Waller told the squad it was supposed to be. As soon as Peacemaker shot the woman washing clothes, I was sure that's how the scene would play out. Sure enough, Flag sitting there drinking tea with the rebel leader, who now has lost a lot of her force. As predictable as the scene was for me, everyone's reaction made it all worth it. The squad's reaction when they realize they've basically committed multiple acts of friendly fire was tragically comedic. Any movie that includes a Fratelli song gets bonus points from me. The funny thing is, Whistle for the Choir is nowhere close to being my favorite song from them, but the fact that they got included was great. In general, the music was excellent, from opening the movie with Johnny fucking Cash singing Folsom Prison Blues, to the opening credits playing People Who Died, to Harley breaking out of prison to Louis Prima's classic version of Just a Gigolo. The music was damn near perfect. This reminds me about the first movie that, to be fair, had a lot of great music. But it got crammed and changed so quickly, you thought you were watching a commercial for the latest compilation album from Sessions Presents. This time the music was paced out well and didn't disrupt the movie, so kudos to James Gunn for that. The alien creatures in the aquarium were not necessary, but were cute and interesting. And I did wonder when they first appeared if they would be predators. And I was right. As I mentioned earlier, I was getting pretty tired of King Shark up to that point, and his childlike reaction to the creatures gave me just enough likability for him to last the remainder of the movie. And admittedly, Stallone was great as the voice. The acting in general was fantastic. Everyone seemed to embrace their part and run with it. You just know certain actors are going to be incredible. Idris Elba and Viola Davis are among the best in the business as far as I'm concerned. Davis is the perfect Amanda Waller, and I can't think of anyone else who could pull off the right mixture of fury and trepidation she shows when she's ready to trigger the bombs on the surviving members of the squad. Elba channeled his 5 seasons as the tormented DCI John Luther and packs every bit of it into his performance as Bloodsport. Margot Robbie has played Harley Quinn 3 times now, and I think she had a good grasp on the character from the beginning. We all know she starts out as Joker's girlfriend and sidekick. That's the way she started when she was created for Batman the Animated Series, and that's the way she was when she transitioned into the comic books as a character in the main DC universe. However, in the past 2 decades in the comics, she has come into her own as a standalone character. She eventually recognizes the toxicity of her relationship with the Joker and sets off on her own. Any character, even sidekicks and secondary characters, can be amazing in the hands of the right creative team and can be the star of their own story. Read Jimmy Palmiotti's and Amanda Conner's Harley Quinn and you'll understand what I mean. When the Birds of Prey movie came out, there were a handful of people who didn't think a sidekick deserved her own movie. Those are obviously people who haven't kept up with the character in the comic books. I know Birds of Prey didn't thrill a lot of people, but I would certainly put it at least in the good, not great category. And even if you question the various changes to characters like Huntress and Black Canary, you have to admit it was a good effort to break Harley away from being Joker's girlfriend to a force in her own right. Even if the first Suicide Squad was a misstep and Birds of Prey had its issues, Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn is a bright spot in each movie, including the Suicide Squad. There were a couple of moments when very subtle things Robbie did raised the bar. When Javelin dies before he can finish his final sentence, she slowly reaches out, seemingly to touch his face goodbye, but instead slaps him, trying to revive him long enough to finish what he said. Even though that joke has come up in movies before, it was still funny. The other two moments that immediately come to mind are two facial expressions. The first was seen in the trailer, when the team is seconds away from their attempt to free Harley, when she comes up from behind them to reveal she's already escaped on her own. She's standing there in her tattered dress, nose bloodied, holding the javelin with this bright, happy, clueless expression staring back at Flag. And even though I'd seen it a couple of times before from the trailer, it still got to me, and I laughed. The other is when she's being tortured, faking unconsciousness. The guard turns his back, and she looks up with this beautifully chilling, murderous look in her eye just before she wraps her legs around the guard to snap his neck. Wow. David S. Malkian and Daniela Melchior, and I hope I'm pronouncing your names correctly, were definitely the characters to care about in this film. Gunn described Melchior's Ratcatcher as the heart of the film, and she really is. She's the only one who never hesitates to do the honorable thing. Desmalchian's Polka Dot Man is the most tragic character who, despite some creepy and disturbing things about him, makes the turning point and embraces his shortcomings, turning them into strengths, understanding his purpose in life to be a better person, and then gets squashed by a giant alien starfish. Damn it. Peter Capaldi just killed it as the Thinker, especially with the reveal of the U.S. government's connection to Starro. I mean, talk about making the most of a small role. I can understand why so many Whovians love him. He goes off with this self-righteous diatribe about he couldn't have done any of it without the government's help, as it sinks into Flag that he's fighting for the side that brought so much death and misery to Corto Maltese. Joel Kinnaman really got to lift Rick Flag to a much higher level than the first movie. He was funny, his character was smarter, and it was just a damn shame Peacemaker kills him. By the way, did anyone else notice that we didn't actually see TDK die, and it was never confirmed that he was dead? The last we see, he is in critical condition. Just saying. There were some fantastic one-liners that seemed to come out of nowhere, even though it was in the trailers. TDK, musing about what kind of dog Weasel is supposed to be, deadpans, "I'm gonna go with Afghan Hound." It just gets to me every time. And after shooting the dictator, Harley, among other things, says, "And RIP to that beautiful monster between your legs." I burst into laughter. The whole arc for Weasel was great. They really establish him as a despicable character who kills children, but you can tell he's really more animal than human. I love that Gunn was inspired to make Weasel like Bill the Cat from the Bloom County, Outland, and Opus comic strips. That really shows in the character, from licking the glass in his cell as Bloodsport looks on, to the scream he lets out as he falls into the water, to being the first character to seemingly die by drowning, to the reveal that he's still alive, wakes up on the beach, looks around in confusion, gets up, and is now wandering the jungles of Corto Maltese. It's just priceless. And I don't know how anyone else feels about this, but the absolute funniest thing and my favorite moment in the whole damn movie for me, did anyone check on whether Weasel could swim? I want that on a t-shirt. The first time I watched 2016's Suicide Squad, I liked it, but my feelings for the movie diminished after rewatching it a couple of times. Conversely, I've watched The Suicide Squad a second time, and my initial feelings for it improved. Even with some flaws and things I didn't like, I would still recommend this movie to any comic book fan. For non-comic book fans, I would recommend it with the caveat that they have to understand that it embraces all the craziness from across the history of comic books, from 60s ridiculousness to 90s ultra-violence to modern-day irony. This movie is a step in the right direction for R-rated superhero movies. It's a step in the right direction for the DCEU after Wonder Woman 84. Most importantly, this is a huge step in the right direction for the Suicide Squad. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.